Howdy, my name is Thomas Zuffer. I'm a sophomore BIMS major, and I'm a member of the Wilson Students Association here at Texas A&M University. On behalf of the MSA, I would like to welcome all of you and thank all of y'all for coming to our third event in our Islam Awareness Month program series. I would also like to give a special thanks to our sponsors, the Islamic Community of Bryan College Station and the Texas A&M Department of Multicultural Services. Islam Awareness Month is organized by the MSA in an effort to reach out to our fellow Aggies in our community, help develop an understanding about Islam, and build bridges of communication. With these events, we hope to clear misconceptions about Islam and answer questions you might have about Islam or Muslims in general. So what does it mean to be a Muslim in America? Muslims face challenges that other Muslims have faced, that other Americans have faced in the past, assumptions that test their loyalty to their country and the boundaries of their faith. Also, people seek to stigmatize Muslims for following what is known as Sharia. In tonight's lecture, we would like to outline what Sharia is, what it consists of, and how it fits under the framework of American law. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to say that we will have a 15-minute long session for questions and answers. So if we could all hold our questions to the end, that would make the event go more smoothly. I'm excited to introduce our speaker, Sheikh Joe Bradford. Joe Bradford was born in Detroit, Michigan and raised in Jacksonville, Florida. In 1991, he embraced Islam as his personal faith and began religious studies at the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. He traveled within the United States and abroad pursuing religious knowledge. In 1999, he was granted a scholarship at the prestigious University of Medina, where he completed the bachelor's program in Islamic law. He went on to be the first American to enter the Graduate School of Law in the university's history. In 2009, he was awarded a master's in Islamic law, earning a mark of distinction with honors for his research. Joe has been active in community and interfaith events, building bridges of understanding for various communities and organizations on the topics of Islam, Islamic law, faith, and community relations. Joe is resident scholar and imam at the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. Without further ado, I'd like to pass the mic on to Sheikh Joe Bradford.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon all of you, and good evening. It's nice to be here with you guys in College Station. This is my first time coming here to College Station. One thing that, when we talk about the topic, just to kind of jump into the topic since the time is short, when we talk about the topic of Sharia, when we hear it mentioned in the news, when it comes up in the media, we often conjure up images of barbaric practices, of backward people trying to impose their own laws or their personal practices on others, on things that we look at as being from a different time and a different place, actions that are promoted by a fifth column that has no place in establishing its rule over the unknowing and the unwilling good people of the American society. Those are the things that many times when we hear the word Sharia come up to mind. But tonight we want to talk about what actually Sharia consists of, what the word means, and how it fits into not only the history of the United States, but underneath the laws of the United States. I'd like to start off with what we should all be starting off with, and that is the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. What does it mean to be we the people? Who were the people that wrote the Constitution, that made up the polity of the Americas at that time in order to form the United States? Who were those people? Many times we know of our history, but there are other parts of our history that might be unknown to some of us. For example, Islam and Muslims in early America. Who were the Muslims or who were the Americans that were there in early America? The citizens of Chesterfield County, Virginia, they wrote in a statement to their state assembly on November 14, 1785, this is a few years before the Constitution was ratified. They said, talking about the issues of state establishment of religion and who it is that makes up the American people. They said, let Jews, Mohammedans is another term that's used historically for Muslims, even though Muslims don't use it themselves, but it's usually meant to be followers of Muhammad. So Muslims, let Jews, Mohammedans, i.e. Muslims, and Christians of every denomination enjoy religious liberty. Thrust them not out now by establishing the Christian religion, lest thereby we become our own enemies and weaken this infant state. It is men's labor in our manufactories, their services by sea and land that aggrandize our country and not their creeds. Chain your citizens to the state by their interest. Let Jews, Mohammedans, i.e. Muslims, and Christians of every denomination find their advantage in living under your laws. Now, the reason why I wanted to mention this statement made by the citizens of Virginia is because many times people will bring statements by, for example, Ben Franklin. Now, Ben Franklin, after he had built the Liberty Hall in Philadelphia, he said, "We have established this hall for the use of all people who come to this country. Even if the Grand Mufti of Constantinople was to send to us a Mohammedan to preach to him, to preach to us the faith or the religion of Muhammad, we would gladly accept." Paraphrasing. We have instances of Thomas Jefferson owning the Quran. We have James Madison has mentioned things about Muslims. Muslims were prominently mentioned by some of our founding fathers. That's not strange because they were educated men. They were worldly men. They were men who had read and had studied. Thomas Jefferson himself, he owned a copy of the Quran. And if you look even amongst the founding fathers, and if you look at the establishment of the U.S. Supreme Court, at the top of the Supreme Court is a set of engravings of the great lawgivers. Amongst them is Confucius, Moses, and the Prophet Muhammad as well. Why I wanted to mention this statement from the citizens of Chesterfield, Virginia, was because it's easy to quote one of the founding fathers and say they had a knowledge of Muslims that lived in some far-off land, and they had a knowledge of their scripture because books had come to them. The translation of George Sale, for example, was owned by Thomas Jefferson. What's little known is that Muslims actually lived in the United States, or they lived in America before the establishment of the United States, not as slaves, but as free men operating within the United States. So there's a long history of Muslims in the United States. This statement by the citizens of Virginia shows that Islam was not a theory to the founding fathers, that there was an actual population of Muslims that existed at that time, however small it may be. So when we talk about we the people, and who are we the people as Americans, we can say that they included Muslims, Christians, Jews, people of other faiths, as well as people of no faith. One of the things that the founding fathers prided themselves on was this would not be a nation that would predicate or promote any religion over another. Even if someone wants to choose atheism or no faith at all, they were allowed to do so. So this attitude amongst the people of the United States, whether they be people of faith or people of no faith, was the thing that brought into existence the First Amendment to the Constitution, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of press, or the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Why is it important to mention this? Because our government is one that does not promote any one religion, and it is not one that denigrates or is there to put down any religion, to remain neutral and to remain out of our private lives. So we as Americans, whether we be people of faith, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, people of no faith, agnostics, atheists, people that have not made a choice, we have the right underneath the First Amendment to not have any religion pushed on us, and we have the right for no religion to be officially promoted by the United States government. Given that frame of context, putting that into context, that there were Muslims in the United States, that they made up we the people, that they were in mind when we spoke about the First Amendment of the Constitution, we now want to talk about what it means to practice Sharia. We'll try and tie it in a little bit. Can I ask anybody here if they know what this is? I like the trash, yes.
It's a desert.
It's a desert, yes. And what's in the desert? Not the stuff in the back, not the mountains. So, this here, this watering hole, this is Sharia. The linguistic meaning of the word Sharia is the watering hole. It's the place that you go to get water when you're traveling to an oasis, when you need nourishment, when you need to sustain yourself. The word was then ported after the advent of Islam to mean the corpus of theological, ethical, and substantive principles that made up the ethos of Islamic thought. So Sharia is something which calls to, number one, theological principles. And of these theological principles, the most important is the first commandment, something which is shared by all three faiths. In Exodus, we find, I am thy Lord thy God. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods in front of me. Mark 12:29. Some of the Pharisees came to Jesus, and they said to him, what is the most important commandment? He said, it is this, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And in the Quran, verse 21:92, this nation of yours is one, and I am your Lord, so worship me. Now, many times when those who would like to detract from the practice of Sharia, they'll say, well, even though Islam is a monotheism, it does recognize a single God. It is not the same God as the Judeo-Christian foundations of our nation. We've already established that the foundation of our nation was not particularly Judeo-Christian. It was something which was respective of all faiths, Islam and other faiths included. But for Muslims, just like the two faiths, or the Abrahamic faiths before us, we have an obligation in our theological system to call to the God of Abraham. In Exodus 3:15, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. In Matthew 22:32, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham. And in the Quran, chapter 3:95, declare to them, God has spoken the truth. Therefore, follow the path of Abraham, for he was not from the polytheists. So for us as Muslims, we believe that Islam is not just a monotheistic religion. It's not just a religion that believes in a single God, but we believe in the God of Abraham, the one that made him a father of many nations, the one that sent him, that sent Jacob, that sent the prophets of the tribes, that sent John and Jesus. The God of all of these prophets is the God of Islam as well. And the reason why I mention this again is to show you the commonalities and the theological underpinnings between what is found amongst our founding fathers and our founding documents and what is found in Islam. Now, when we talk about Islamic law, or we say Sharia. Sharia, as we said, it's that watering hole. It's that source of nourishment. It's that place that you go to find sustenance. It's the ethos. It's the body, the corpus of substantive, ethical, and theological principles. There's a difference between what is called Sharia in the study of Islam as a formal study, as a formal science. The study of Islam, there's a difference between the word Sharia and the difference in between the word fiqh. Fiqh is what we would call law, whether it be procedural law, whether it be the statutes that the individual states come up with, whether it be the precedents that are set by court cases. That is what is considered as Islamic law, or is studied in a science called fiqh. Sharia, however, is a body of principles. If we look to the substantive principles of the Sharia, what do they go back to? They go back to five main objectives, meaning that Islam as a faith came to promote five things. And these are many times called the objectives of Islam, maqasid al-shar, the objectives of the Sharia. Why is there a Sharia? So the first is preservation of life, preservation of faith, preservation of mental health, preservation of family, and preservation of property. So Islam seeks to preserve the Sharia seeks to preserve life. How does it seek to preserve life? It seeks to preserve life by forbidding murder. It seeks to preserve life by allowing marriage and encouraging marriage and forbidding all other immoral and illicit acts that are done outside of marriage. It seeks to preserve life by encouraging people to not only fulfill their desires within a marital bond, but to also procreate so that they can have children. So it seeks to preserve life proactively by legislating certain things for people to do. Marriage, divorce, social interactions, as well as prohibiting certain things which are detrimental to society as a whole, murder, crime, so on and so forth. It seeks to preserve faith, it seeks to allow people to believe what they're going to believe, and to allow them to seek out what is best for them. Mental health. Islam seeks to promote mental health. So if a person cannot live their life in peace, they can't pursue happiness, they can't live without a fear of crime or a fear of criminals, if they can't live without a fear of their own faith or fear from being persecuted for their faith, then they're obviously going to have problems with their mental health. They're not going to feel that they're in a stable situation. Islam seeks to prevent or to promote mental health in this instance. Also, it seeks to promote mental health by forbidding things which are detrimental to a person's mental state. So intoxicants are forbidden for Muslims to ingest. Alcohol, drugs, anything which is detrimental to a Muslim's body is therefore going to be detrimental to his mental health, and therefore is going to be something which Islam does not encourage and in fact discourages. Islam seeks to promote and to preserve the family. The family unit, you might say, well, if you've already spoken about life, why would you then mention the family? Because life happens without a family or not. But the thing is that the Islamic faith wants to make sure that people not only know who their families are, but that they have strong families, that the family remains as a unit which works within society to help promote the values of that society. So it encourages marriage, encourages procreation. It also encourages a sense of privacy for families. There is a phenomenon right now in the United States where many courts have gone beyond bounds in legislating things for families where you have no choice but to do what the court wants you to do. So I've heard of cases, for example, some friends who are family lawyers who will say that maybe a child is unruly and, you know, goes to juvenile or something like that, or gets convicted for a crime because they're underage, then the parents are fined or they are taken to account for not raising the child properly. Well, if you don't allow the parents to be able to reprimand their children, and we're not talking about physical, but to be able to reprimand their children and to raise them the way that they see fit, then you can't really take the parents to account for the way that the child turns out. So it's a dual system. You have to allow parents to raise the children with the values that they seem fit, and the state should only intervene when the welfare of those children is at danger. Lastly, property. Islam seeks to preserve property. So there's the concept of private property, of freedom of contract, that not only should individuals work together in buying and selling with in fair trade and with consent, but that the state should not impose itself on on society and be able to take from people their property without right. Now, these substantive principles, obviously, they lead us to underlying ethical principles. So we have, first of all, a basis for human rights. There's a verse in the Quran that says, وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ, and we have honored the children of Adam. So, we have a base respect that is due to all human beings because they are human. Then we look at our brotherhood as something which is of levels. The Prophet Muhammad said, none of you will truly believe until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself. Scholars of Islam have said, this love for your brother is of three types, or it's of three levels. The first level is the brotherhood of humanity, that you love every person because they are a child of Adam and Eve, because they are a human being. You respect them because of that. The second level is the brotherhood of lineage. So just as you have blood brothers and blood sisters, you're obviously going to have a higher level of respect for them than you would for someone outside of your family. You're going to be a little bit more protective. You're going to be a little bit more concerned with them. And then you're also going to have a level of the brotherhood of faith, that when you share faith with other people, you're also going to respect them, honor them, and protect them because of their faith. So none of these three should infringe on any level underneath it. So they're on par. They're actually not levels that are above each other. There's another ethical principle, as another example of the ethical principles under the Sharia, no harm, la darara wa la dirar, that there should be no harm, no reciprocating harm. This is a tradition that was stated by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as well as a legal maxim that was used in the corpus of Islamic law. So, for example, when we talked about the preservation of mental health and how intoxicants are forbidden for Muslims to take, this goes into no harm and no reciprocating harm. So someone might say to themselves, well, I'm not giving drugs to someone else, so it shouldn't be a problem for me to take them myself. I'm not giving anyone else alcohol, but I should be able to drink it myself. The Muslim sees it in a different way. We see it in that you should not be giving anything to anyone that would harm them, and you should not be harming yourself as well. So therefore, we as Muslims will not take intoxicants, whether it be alcohol or any form of drug. Another principle underneath Islamic law, the principle of reasonable doubt. They say in Arabic, "Tudar al-hudud bi-shubuhat," that punishments are mitigated by doubt. Anytime someone is going to be sentenced, someone is accused, they have the ability to go to court, to have a hearing in front of a judge, and if there's any reasonable doubt that they have committed that crime or not committed that crime, they should not be sentenced for something that there is no proof, conclusive proof, that they have done. So this is something which, if you look to the American legal system, is on par with the Muslim legal system as well. Lastly, consent. Consent is something which all of us can relate to. We consent each day to relating to each other, to speaking to each other. When we want to go into a business agreement, we consent to doing business with each other, which means we have fair dealings, there's fair trade, we're honest, we deal with each other with equity and with fairness. When we want to marry, there has to be consent in a Muslim marriage. There's no such thing under Islamic law as forced marriage. Now, I will make a point here. We're talking here today, theoretically, we're talking about the principles. There are things that have happened throughout Islamic history. There are things that Muslims themselves do and they continue to do, thinking that it is part of their faith and that is promoted by the principles of their faith. But if you go back to the theory, you go back to the principles of faith, you'll find that it's much different than the actual practice. Every society has had to deal with this problem. We as Americans have had to deal with this problem in our own constitution. People of African American descent were not seen as being full human beings. But however, this problem was then corrected, and amendments were made to the Constitution to get rid of this issue, to right this wrong. And we still have problems with race, with religion, with equality in our society. So Muslims are human beings, they've gone through the same things. So you'll find in Muslim cultures, in Muslim countries, certain things are done underneath the auspices of their religion, but in fact, they are not based in the religion at all. And the theological underpinnings. We talked about a few of these. Worship of God alone. Affirmation of his prophets. If you believe in God, if you believe that he has given messengers or sent his message to messengers, and you believe that they have brought to you the substantive and the ethical principles that you should live your life by to be good people, you should naturally recognize as well that there will be reckoning in the next life, that you will be held accountable for your actions. And so when you are interacting with your fellow human beings, with your fellow citizens, you will realize that not only should I be fair with someone in business because it's good to be fair, but because I will one day be held accountable by my Lord, and I will have to answer for everything that I have done, both good and bad. And lastly, mutual respect of other faiths. This is one thing that is part of the Sharia, to have respect for other faiths. And the Quran, it says, وَلَا تَسُبُّ الَّذِينَ يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ فَيَسُبُّ اللَّهَ عَدْوًا بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ. And do not curse those that they call on other than God. Otherwise, they will then curse God out of enmity and ignorance. So it's not permissible for a person, even if he does not believe or share the beliefs of another person, to then hold them in disdain, publicly disparage them, and make them feel bad about their personal choices. But you're not allowed to speak bad about a person's faith, even when you disagree with it. Another verse, لا إكراه في الدين قد تبين الرشد من الغي. There's no coercion in religion. Truth has remained clear from falsehood. This verse, obviously, has gone through a lot of discussion amongst Muslim scholars and themselves as to how it is to be applied, when it was to be applied, And that's a discussion that we can maybe take up on another time. But the principle, the underlying principle, is that no one should be forced to accept the faith that they don't truly believe in. And lastly, even when you might recognize these other faiths, you have to have respect for those other faiths. And I'll leave you, before we end this slide, I'll leave you with one instance from the life of the Prophet Muhammad that shows us how Muslims are to embody the mutual respect of other faiths. Now, as we know, in Medina, there was a population of a Jewish community that lived in Medina at the time of the Prophet. And they were given their religious autonomy. They ruled themselves, and they lived by themselves. And they had called the Prophet to come to them, come to their Beth Midrash, their Beth Midrash, their school, and to arbitrate a dispute that they had amongst their community. And so when he came to them, and they sat in a room, not like we're sitting right now, they didn't have chairs, but they sat on the floor, the dirt floor, and because the Prophet Muhammad was the guest of honor, they gave him a pillow to sit on. And so when they told him of the dispute, he told them, "Bring me the Torah." And when they brought the Torah, he took the pillow out from underneath him and he placed it in front of him. He then took the Torah and placed it on the pillow with his own two hands, placed his right hand on the Torah, and he said, "I believe in you, and I believe in the one who revealed you." So even though there was a difference of faith, there was a difference in how to characterize the following of that religious text, that respect for the symbols, respect for the texts, respect for the things which are honored by people of other faith is something which is paramount to upholding your own faith. If you want people to respect you, then you have to respect others. Because of this, it's not permissible for Muslims to denigrate neither the religious symbols and texts of others, nor the national symbols of texts of others. So flag burning is something which is not acceptable Islamically, unless, of course, it's being done in a flag ceremony to retire that flag because of something happening to it, some type of damage to it. But to denigrate the national symbols is the same as denigrating the religious symbols of other people. So Sharia is the substance. It's the ethos, it's the principles, it's the broad topics that come in the text of the Quran, the text of the Sunnah, the traditions of the Prophet. Fiqh is the application, is the precedent, the statutes, the minutiae that come. And when you look at these topics that we just talked about, you'll see that they can be divided generally into things that have to do with God's rights and things that have to do with man's rights. So God has certain rights over us because of our being believers in Him. And man has other rights over us because we share the earth with Him. So when we look at both God's rights and man's rights, we can see that we have things which are personal: prayer, fasting, pilgrimage, food and drink. These are all things which Muslims, or Islamic law, characterizes as part and parcel of God's right. So God has the right to be prayed to. He asks you to pray in a certain way. Fast in a certain way. Make pilgrimage to the places that His prophets and messengers have consecrated for pilgrimage to. To eat and drink certain things and to not eat and drink certain things. We have private dealings. These are the parts that have to do mainly with man's rights. Contracts. Private contracts between two parties. Marriage. Marriage is a private contract between two parties. Marriage is not, as it is in other faiths, an eternal spiritual union between two souls. As Muslims, we believe it to be a civil contract like any other contract, but it is there for the promotion of healthy society. Divorce. Divorce is something which is found in Islamic law, and there are certain rulings for it. Probate, inheritance, bequeathments, trusts, there are all laws for this underneath Islamic law. We also have underneath Islamic law, when Muslim scholars throughout the ages looked back to that corpus of information, they found adjudication, governance, international relations, criminal justice. So, yeah, you'll hear about, I'm not going to sit up here and deny that there's capital punishment under Islamic law. But yes, there is corporal punishment for certain crimes underneath Islamic law. But when we look to the corpus of Islamic law, we'll find that 65% of all of the issues that are handled in texts or Islamic legal texts have to do with issues which are purely personal practice, whether they be practiced based on faith, or that you practice like, such as oaths and food and drink and so on and so forth. 20% of the issues that are mentioned have to do with private agreements between, or agreements between private parties, contracts, buying, selling, partnerships, endowments, transactional issues. Then the last 10% probate, custody, marriage, divorce. And lastly, 5%, only 5% of Islamic legal texts deal with the issues which are sensationalized mostly, such as Islamic courts, the penal code, sentencing, criminal justice, punishments, so on and so forth. Now, why would I even mention this slide, or why did I bring this up? I wanted to bring this up to let you know that when we talk about Sharia, or Islamic law, and its application under American law, or in the American context, there is an agreement amongst Muslim scholars that the 65% here is something which is private, that no one has the ability to judge a person because of their prayer or lack of prayer. No one knows if you're fasting, if you're not. They don't know if you're drinking during the daytime or not. They don't know if you've made your pilgrimage or not. Yes, there might be some social issues. People might socialize and know whether a person prays or fasts or not. But in essence, your faith is something which is between you and between God. Food and drink. Whether you eat pork or not, it's not something which will have a bearing on your faith. Whether you agree that it's forbidden or not will have a bearing on your faith. So 65% of the Islamic law has completely personal practice. It does not go into the private affairs that are agreements between private parties. It's nothing. It has nothing to do with public law. There's consensus amongst Muslim scholars that the issues of adjudication, criminal justice, the penal code, international relations, anything doing with state law, anything pertaining to state law, is the domain of the sovereign authorities of the state in which you live in, whether they be Muslim or non-Muslim, whether they be Muslim, of other faiths, or of no faith at all. Meaning that no Muslim has the right to then say, someone has done this, I'm going to then have vigilante justice and apply the law against them. This is by consensus of Muslim scholars, something which is not allowed. Which is why the scourge of terrorism, the problem of terrorism, is a problem which is not only legalistically problematic for those that promote it as Islamic, because they're going against the consensus of centuries of Islamic scholarship, but it's also theologically problematic. Because when you start to think that you have control over your fellow man, and when you become unsatisfied with that which God himself has destined to happen, when you start to disbelieve in God's providence, you start to then make yourself the final arbiter of what is right and wrong, and therefore you're placing yourself as a god besides God. And that is polytheism, and something which is tantamount to leaving the Islamic faith, which is why even amongst Muslim theologians, there is a classic debate as to whether people who involve themselves in terrorist acts are actually Muslims or not, because of themselves going down a slippery slope of allowing themselves to place themselves in God's shoes. So therefore, adjudication, penal code, criminal justice, punishments, this is all inadmissible. This will never come up for Muslims living in a land which does not rule by Islamic law. Acts that are personal. They're private. They're personal. They're to yourself. You have nothing. They bear nothing on the people around you. They bear only upon yourself. Probate and custody. Again, they're issues which cannot be decided except by the sovereign authorities, the courts, in the land that you live in. You're therefore left with 20%, about 22-24% of Islamic law, which is actually applicable in any other legal system. And those things which are applicable are those things which are private agreements between two people. So, how do we apply Islamic law under American law? If less than 30% is subject to litigation or arbitration, and only private rights between two parties can be arbitrated, You have custody, as we said, was excluded because it involves a third party. So a Muslim couple cannot come and say, well, we were married and now we're going to get a divorce and we want the sheikh at the local mosque to decide who gets custody of our child. It's not allowed. Why? Because it has to do with the welfare of a third party, and determining the welfare of third parties is the domain of the state and of the authorities that are there. Probate is excluded because it's procedural. All you're doing is taking someone's will and testament and making sure that their inheritance, their bequeathments are distributed as they had wished. Arbitration. The only way that Muslims can apply Islamic law is through an agreement between another Muslim. So if I go into business with you to sell widgets, to sell used cars, or to sell UT memorabilia, because there's not going to be any more games now, different conference, so it's all cheap because the Aggies obviously are still selling, still better, right? If we go into business, we're going to do a wholesale, and we say, you know what? We don't want to have to go to court. We don't want to litigate. We're going to choose a separate arbitration council. Whether that be a Muslim arbiter, whether that be a person of another faith, whether it be a professional arbiter from a professional association, our rights as Americans is to arbitrate. So arbitration under American law is only binding when it is not in contravention to American law. So even if we go to a third party to arbitrate for us, if they make a decision which goes against established law, it will not be recognized by the courts and it won't be enforced. If we find that they have done that, we can then go and litigate and go back to the courts. And court judgments are legally binding. There is a concept in Islamic law, which is the concept of al-aman, or security, that when you go into a country that is not ruling by Islamic law, you will then respect the laws that are there, that are applied in that country, and you will follow them as legally binding. You might not agree with them on a moral basis. You might not agree with them on an ethical basis, but you will agree with them on a legal basis, and you will make sure that they're carried out if judgment is passed against you. This concept is exactly equal to the concept in the Jewish faith of Dina de Melechuta Dina, that the law of the land is the law. So everything that doesn't deal with private personal affairs, that doesn't have to do with the state, because that's particularly the domain of the state, if it has been decided upon by two private parties to arbitrate, that is acceptable and it's arbitrated according to Islamic law. If they decide to go and litigate, they have the right to do that as well. So when we talk about religious parallels between Islam and the Jewish faith, Islam and the Christian faith, Islam and people of no faith, Muslims just as part of we the people. We many times ask ourselves questions. Can a Jew be a good American? Is this an acceptable question? Can a Jew be a good American? No, and this is not an acceptable question. And were I asking this question as if not as a rhetorical question, I would probably be accused of anti-Semitism, I would be accused of not being inclusive, I would be accused of being backwards. But this was a question in America at one time. Can a Jew be a good American? The Jewish people were persecuted, even in the United States. At times, you'll find that Jews have their own arbitrational tribunals. They follow their own religious law. They have halakha, or rabbinical courts, that operate much in the same way that we described Islamic law operates. Dina de melechuta dina, the law of the land is the land, means that your religious laws and your private agreements can be agreed by religion, or can be litigated or adjudicated upon by a rabbinical court underneath the laws of arbitration. But if they're taken to the state, then the state litigates. You have to follow that law. Can a Catholic be a good American? This is another question that kind of panned out in the 50s and the 60s. I think John F. Kennedy was one of the last people that they really talked about whether he could really be a president because he was a Catholic, and could a Catholic actually be loyal to the United States and loyal to the papacy at the same time. So, at one time, Jews were seen as a fifth column, Catholics were seen as a fifth column, as well as other people of different religions and ethnicities. But Catholics as well have their own canonical tribunals. They go and they mediate their disputes according to canon law. And this is not questioned as being against American law. Can a Muslim be a good American? This is the question that we face today. It's the question that is promoted as being the question of the hour. And in Islam, we have Islamic arbitration, mediation, but as we said, the Sharia, okay, the corpus of Islamic principles, is something which Muslims practice and they believe in. The Islamic law, or the fiqh, the application of those principles, can only be applied in very narrow spheres of private interaction and in the very narrow sphere of personal interaction or personal practice. So, as long as Jewish law, Catholic law, Islamic law, Antarctican law, whatever law that you want, operates underneath U.S. law, then yes, you can be a good American. As long as you uphold the common values that we as Americans hold fast to, then yes, you can be a good American. So the question is not, can a Muslim be a good American? The question is, why a Muslim must be a good American? And they must be a good American because it is a Quranic imperative. That even though we ascribe to a corpus of religious principles that might differ with those that are around us, we also, within those principles, have three verses from the Quran, many other statements and traditions in the Islamic corpus of text that say, Ya ayyuhal ladina amanu, awfu bil uqood. O you who believe, fulfill your covenants. So, our social contract, our agreement to be citizens of the United States, that social contract, that agreement to live with each other in peace, is part of our faith. That if you want to be a true believer, then you must fulfill your covenant of agreeing to live in peace, safety, and security, and promote the common values of the state and the country that you live in. أَوْفُ بِالْعَهْدِ إِنَّ الْعَهْدَ كَانَ مَسْئُولًا. Fulfill your covenants, for you will be asked about them. In another verse of the Quran. وَكَانَ عَهْدُ اللَّهِ مَسْئُولًا. And God's covenant will be asked about. So, to conclude, it's not about whether Sharia law is something which is in clash with American law, but it is something that, like Jewish religious law, like Catholic religious law, like the private agreements that any two Americans might go into, can and does fit under and work within the American system. And I'll leave you with this. Anyone that would want to make you believe that less than 2% of the American population, Muslims are less than 2% of the American population, are somehow going to take over and beat the will of the entirety of American people and force their religious law upon them, have very little faith, not only in our system of America, of American law, but in our resolve as American people to ensure rights for all of us as Americans, whether we have faith or whether we do not. So I think with that, we will open the floor for questions.
Okay, so we do have a few minutes for questions and answers. If you could just politely raise your hand, I'll be more than happy to call on you. And Jake Joe will answer it for you.
Yes. My name is Salah, I'm from Iraq. I have a question about what you said, that Sharia and law fit together. I would like to know your opinion as a convert and imam in the mosque in these three points. If someone wants to get married for a second or third marriage, are you going to follow the Sharia or the American law? Second, women in Islam witnessing require two women if it is required one man. That woman witnessing is half a man.
Mm-hmm.
Also, which one will agree? This one or this one? Point number three. Inheritance in Islam for women is half what men got. So which one you will follow? Sharia or American law? Thank you.
So the first one was the issue of performing marriages. and plural marriage is polygamy. The second question was?
About witnessing and
witnesses. And the third was about inheritance. Our policy in the Islamic Center that I am the imam is that we do not perform any marriages outside of civil law, meaning that if someone comes to my mosque and they say, I want to get married, number one, they have to sign up for a 12-week premarital counseling session to make sure that they're compatible as spouses, to make sure that they know about each other. Then, once they've made the decision to actually get married, they have to go to the courthouse, get the papers from the courthouse, bring me the state marriage license, and then myself, as a clergyman, or a notary public that's in our community, will then notarize that agreement. They have to agree to get married underneath the state law before we'll perform any marriages. Why? Because I think that polygamy is necessarily wrong. I think that polygamy is something that historically is applied in different places for different reasons and at different times. But in our American context, I find that many times people will try to use marriage, and specifically polygamy, for the abuse of women, for the abuse of the bond of marriage. And that means that they're using something from the minutia of Islam to try and override and overtake a core principle, which is a principle of justice. So therefore, we can't allow something from the minutiae to overtake a core principle, one of the substantive principles, which is the preservation of the family. Therefore, we don't allow that in our mosque, and I don't perform any marriages outside of that.
So you will follow the American law, not Sharia?
I'm sorry?
You will follow the American law, not Sharia?
No, I'm following both, actually.
But yes. Consider I'm Muslim. I tell you, I have the right to marry again.
I've said that to people. People say, well, they're not getting married to a second wife, but they say, you know what, I don't want to go and get the state marriage license. I said, well, it's America, you're free to go somewhere else. Yeah. I'm not going to perform your marriage. And that's my choice as a private citizen and as a clergyman to decide what is religiously appropriate under the Sharia and what is in congruence with American law.
Due to lack of time, I think we'll only be able to take one question per person, because I'm pretty sure somebody else has some questions.
Okay, let me just touch on the last two points quickly. The issue of witnesses, I would refer you to an article written by Professor Mohammed Fadl of University of Toronto, which speaks about this issue in detail. But in detail, if you look to the history behind the revelation of the verses that talk about women's witness being or two women witnessing to something that one man would witness to, that was because it was revealed at a time in which the witness of women or women were being under considerable social pressure, and they were in paternalistic and male-dominated societies and were many times forced into false witness because of the tribal societies that they were in. Now, in practice throughout Islamic history, you'll find that even though a woman would, that this stipulation was made, the scholars of Islam and the jurists of Islam accepted both the witness, there's this thing called tahammul shahada, where a person takes or witnesses something themselves, and ada shahada, or they then testify to something in court. Testifying to something in court, whether it was one person or two, it was equal amongst men and women. Men and women equally can testify to something in court. However, you might disagree, but I would ask you to go back to the article and read about it first, and then maybe you can call.
Sorry,
the third point, because we have other people, is inheritance. The third point about inheritance, about this is one of the common misconceptions of people that have not studied a very intricate, detailed subject of inheritance in Islam. There are seven situations in which a woman inheritance underneath Islamic law. In three of those instances, she takes less than a man. In one instance, she takes equal to a man. And in three other instances, she takes more than the man. So then in the one instance in which she takes, or the three instances in which she takes less than a man, it's because those men are legally bound to maintain and take care of her financially. That under Islamic family law, women are not obligated to work
or to provide for themselves. If they want to stay at home for the sanctity of the family, to provide for themselves, to provide for the family, and to do what only a mother can do, they have the right to demand of their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, or anyone else in the family that they must provide for them so that they can work for the betterment of the family. So there's 7 situations. It's unjust to say that, 4 out of 7 women are actually getting the same or more than men. So it's not something which is a blanket or a generalization that can really be applied to the whole of inheritance law in Islam. Do we have any more questions? Go ahead.
Based actually on the secular or on the liberty of the liberalism, basically, which is man created the constitution, man created the law. So man's actually are the source of the law. But in Islam, as Muslims, we believe actually that Islam is the right and the correct path, for God, and the corrected law. And it actually has a source of God to some people. So this is very major, actually, different. So I don't think actually that a bit under the American laws. Because this major, you have probably 20% classes, maybe 30%, something like that. But this major difference is really very, very major because we have God's hadith in the Quran and Sunnah, which is our source from God. But the American laws, the source is actually the constitution, which is created by people.
Okay, I would say that the sources of American law are much broader than just the Constitution, as far as philosophically. You find many of the founding fathers who were deists, that they believed in a God that created the world and then stepped away. You find some of them who were adamant about their Christianity, and you had some that were could probably better be described as agnostic. However, in the formation of the Constitution and of the Declaration of Independence, of many of the other founding documents, you will find a religious undercurrent and an attribution of the natural rights that men were endowed with being attributed back to God. So I would think that I would contend a little bit of what you said. I would think that it's not solely based on liberalism. I think that many of our founding fathers were probably extremely conservative according to today's standards. And that when you look at the philosophical underpinnings, it was broader than being just based on one religious system, but it was based upon a multiplicity of different religious backgrounds. Yes?
My question is, do you mind if I don't stand up? My question is kind of the same, let's say 85% of Sharia law is subordinate to American Constitution, and 15% of it is in line with civil law, then there really shouldn't be a controversy over this between Muslims and non-Muslims alike in America. But if the majority of Muslims believe that Sharia law is superior to the Constitution, then wouldn't they consider you to be the one that's in distortion?
They could, but I don't think that the people that hold that belief have very much, that have studied the issue too in depth. And they might be coming from a more emotional basis for their decision than an academic, or research-based decision. I would also say that there's a difference between upholding something as superior morally or ethically and upholding something as superior in guaranteeing the rights that we hold common. So just as someone of the Jewish faith might say, hey, you know what, I believe that Judaism is the truth, and that's my right to believe it as the truth. And that the ultimate arbiter of what is right and wrong is God for me, and it is the laws that are laid out in the Torah. But for the betterment of myself and fellow man, I ascribe to the laws of the United States. I don't think that would be considered strange or anti-American. Neither, and it wouldn't be from any other person that did the same.
We're also accepting written questions too.
All right, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Jeremiah.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, and thank you for your speech. It was very good. The question I had for you is, obviously your understanding of interpretations of Sharia law comes from the school of Islamic law that you were trained in. How does your thoughts relate to some of the other schools of Islamic law as far as Sharia being subordinate to local laws, penal codes, things like that?
I would, to give you a little bit of background about myself, I studied in the University of Medina in Saudi Arabia. And the University of Medina is unique in that it is one of the only universities in the Islamic world that actually does a comparative study of Islamic law. So we draw from the four major schools of Islamic law, as well as some of the more ancient and underused schools that have kind of, you know, fell out of practice. We draw for them for the more, philosophical, kind of debates between how law was created and how it developed. But how would my understanding kind of fall into or agree with other people? The question was.
Well, just I'm more interested in not knowing which exact school you went to. I mean, I understand just to light on that, some of the other schools of law. Do they agree with you? Would some of the other major schools of law also say that Sharia would be subordinate to the local government?
I think they would. I think that you would find, and this is one of the problem. This is one of the problems of who speaks for Islam. We have a crisis within our own community, and it is a crisis which is resultant of a couple of decades of Islamic activism. And the Islamic identity crisis, where colonized peoples were, instead of trying to understand the traditions of their own legal systems and of their practices, sought to create a counterculture which was based upon Islamic, the Islamic legacy, but was not firmly rooted in its theology or its legalities. And that has caused a lot of the strife that you find in Muslim lands. It has caused a lot of the more activist groups and even terrorist groups, and it has been one for the promotion of what is called the clash of civilizations. So it wasn't just people like Samuel Huntington that talked about clashes of civilizations. We had people in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s in the Muslim world who were promoting the same concepts because they saw them as being disparate and utterly unable to be accommodated to each other. Whereas if you look at more traditional scholarship, you will find an accommodation that's there from early on. Even one instance during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, where one of his companions was going to make a ruling against a people. And he told him, he said, when you go to rule, do not rule and say, this is the rule of God, but say, this is my rule, because you don't know what God's rule is. You don't know what God's decision is. So we have this system of principles and things that we posit to be ultimate truths. But how those are actually connected to the realities that we live in will differ from time and place. And that's been one of the beauties of the Islamic system, and it's also been one of the most problematic things for people to understand about the Muslims themselves, because if there's only one truth, then how can it be applied differently in different places? A very simple example is that alcohol is forbidden for Muslims to drink. But if I'm in a restaurant and I'm choking on a meatball at Maggiano's or something like that, and the only thing I have is the bottle of wine that the guy's passing by, walking by, and I grab that bottle of wine and I drink it so that I can get, in that instance, it's permissible. In fact, it's obligatory for me to drink wine because that's what's going to save my life. It's important not to have kind of a black and white dichotomy of yes and no. One of the things I didn't get into was the categorization of rulings underneath Islam. You have things which are forbidden, things which are disliked, things which are just baseline permissible, doesn't matter if you do it or not, things which are recommended for you to do, and things which are obligatory. Had everything been black and white, we wouldn't have that diversity in categorizing how to understand the things that we do and when to apply them.
We have time for one more question.
Yes, this is kind of a three-part question, so bear with me. Have you explained this in this manner to, like, say, lawmakers in, like, Washington? If so, what was their response to it? And then my next part is, this seems to be kind of a war of information versus emotion. And are they aware, like, are the lawmakers aware of that kind of conflict in this whole thing?
How would I explain that? I haven't had the opportunity to explain it to lawmakers in Washington, but I think I would explain it much like I explained it today. I do have a few friends that are professors and that work with think tanks and things like that, and they have even written articles on the subject. I think that it's something which is known, and I would agree with you that it is a kind of a war of information versus emotion, and that you have the underlying problem are our own personal prejudices. We have a problem in our Muslim communities of thinking ourselves to be superior to everyone and not agreeing that I would be underneath any law system or any other decision-making body, even if I disagreed morally and ethically. And we have a problem as Americans accepting that our pluralism should be broad enough to accept those that even disagree with us, as long as we follow the law. So when those two get together, that's kind of where the emotion comes into it. What was the second question?
Is this kind of informed view of the way the law behaves, is this school of thought that you subscribe to growing?
I think it is, and I think the more that you find informed, educated American Muslim leaders who have a acute knowledge of the context in which they live, as well as a deep understanding of the traditions of their faith, then you will find this becoming much more prevalent. The problem has been in the Muslim community that we have lived cocooned for some time, and much of our leadership as well has not been, they've not lived both lives. So for me, I kind of see my purpose as bridging the gap. That's there, letting people know that there's a lot more in common than there is different.